Thanks. I'm Brandon. I'm alcoholic. Okay, so tonight I'm going to go from A Vision for You, which is chapter 11. So if you want to read along, it is page 151. And as I said last time, my idea was to sort of start off with the doctor's opinion, talking about how sick I used to be, and then go into We Agnostics, which I did last week, talking about how I came to believe in power that saved my life. And then this week I kind of wanted to talk about where I am today, you know, and sort of how this program has been for me throughout the years. So let's get started with this. Chapter 11, A Vision for You, begins with, "For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good." So I'm just going to pause there for a second. And later in the page, it says, "Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand." I think that's true not just about the misery that they describe later in the page, but also about that. You know, like being an unhappy drinker and wishing for that to be the case again. I understood what they meant when they said, like, colorful imagination, release from care. When alcohol was working for me, and it was actually like a useful thing in my life, I felt like it brought all of that stuff and more. I felt like it sort of unlocked all the hidden potential that was in me and all the potential that was out there in life that I wasn't able to see before, you know, that I had heard other people talk about, but it just seemed like other people had that and I just didn't. But when I started partying out there, it was a totally different world. You know, it was like the veil had been lifted, and all of a sudden I can see fun. I can see connecting with other people, and I thought that I was cool and, you know, attractive and all these different things, and I thought I was suddenly smarter and funnier and all of this stuff. But more than anything, I felt like I was confident enough to talk to other people on a level playing field. Eventually, by a lot of drinking, I thought I was on the higher side of the playing field and sort of better than most of those people once I was drinking. But up until that point, I always sort of felt like less than. And I felt like drinking leveled the playing field. And all of a sudden, I could have all this stuff. So yeah, I relate to that very strongly. And when I was an unhappy drinker, I understood very well. And seems to be the case with almost all this book for me. So moving on from there, they say, "The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure." Like I sort of touched on, yeah, abso-frickin-lutely. If alcohol is the only tool in my toolbox and you take that out, then I'm pretty well screwed. You know, it was my tool that enabled me to connect with other people, to deal with boredom, to deal with loneliness, to deal with sadness, anxiety, you know, and sort of enable me to have fun and be with people. You take that away from me and I'm pretty well screwed. So yeah, I just kept going back and going back and going back, trying to figure out a way to make this thing work, but it just, you know, it wasn't working. So eventually I ended up where this goes next, which is, "The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily, we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand." And boy, did I understand that. It's funny how alcohol originally was the thing that enabled me to connect with other people. And I thought, like, it finally gave me a satisfactory social life, one that I felt was actually worthwhile. Prior to that, you know, I hung out with people and did whatever, but didn't really feel that much of a connection. But when I linked up with other drinkers, it was different. You know, whatever magic took place at drinking and partying was just totally different than anything I experienced before. So it's funny that eventually led to alcohol separating me from every single thing that I valued that it originally provided. You know, that talking about before, the conviviality and companionship and all this stuff, and by the end I had withdrawn. And I remember being it used to be the office in Cranford, and I was there I guess around like maybe lunchtime, and I was already wrecked because I had been drinking since the morning. And I was drinking alone, like over there at one of those high top tables, and I saw some of my old friends come in, and I remember they gave me this look of pity. And it broke my heart, you know, because I knew that the person I had become, I was no longer the life of the party. I wasn't funny or cool or any of that stuff. I was pitiful. And, you know, the one thing that I thought had unlocked all of my potential really robbed me of all the potential I had. It's interesting how that goes, right? You know, it's like alcohol the solution becomes alcohol the problem. And I can't see it because it's, like I said, it's the only thing I have. It's the only tool in my toolbox, the only toy in my toy box, however you want to call it. It's all I had. I had nothing else. And so I couldn't wrap my head around the idea that it was something that was killing me. I thought that there was going to be a way to, it was going to work again. But it wasn't, you know. At that point, it had forced me to completely withdraw from society because drinking with other people just didn't work, and for a variety of reasons, you know. And if you've done that, I'm sure you understand too. Like drinking in a bar, eventually, if you drink a lot, it gets really expensive, and I couldn't afford that. You know, and me making an ass out of myself continuously, eventually, I didn't want to be around other people because I would. You know, and eventually they didn't want me around either because it causes problems. You know, the kind of behavior that I had caused problems. And I didn't want people judging me, and I didn't want to end up in a fight or somebody taking my car keys yet again or any of that stuff. And so it was like much safer and cheaper for me to just drink alone in my parents' basement. And I'd basically completely withdrawn. All I had was like me and the girl I was dating at the time. And we would sit in my parents' unfinished basement on like metal folding chairs. And I would sit on the computer and she would watch television. And that's what we did. And that's where we ended up. And it's really sad, you know, because like I said, originally it was a party until it wasn't, right? So waking up and feeling terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I mean, when I used to wake up and not know what I did, and then you find out that, well, I would find out that somebody was pissed off at me, and I didn't know why, that is awful. You know, and I just felt like bewildered and frustrated, terrified, like, what the hell did I do? Or how did I get here? Where am I? You know, those types of things, it's just awful. So I love this book, I really do. I love the creative language it uses to describe the things that so many of us have experienced. So let's move on to the next. It says, now and then, a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he'd give anything to take half a dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. So I'm going to pause there before we go on. And just out of curiosity, how many people here, just raise your hand, have done that where you stopped drinking and had convinced yourself you're doing great, but were freaking miserable on the inside? Oh, yeah. It's so common. You know, it's almost like, it's almost trite, but it's one of the things that connects us is basically unhappy with being sober. And there's this one guy, I just love the way he said it. He said that we used to go to the bar, like, bartender, can you help me with this? I'm sober, I don't know what to do. And that's kind of how I felt too. Like, oh my God, what is this condition? I don't like it. And that, I didn't like being sober in the most general possible sense. And the reason for that is I was an absolute emotional disaster when I was sober. I mean, before I actually went through this program and did what was suggested here, I remember probably the best thing I can describe to you is my friend said that they used to hate arguing with me because I refused to ever be wrong, and I was almost always wrong. You know, and that was where I was. You know, I was completely detached from reality, but I was willfully fighting against it. And I could not be wrong because I was too fragile. If I was wrong about anything, I just couldn't handle it. I was like too embarrassed, too sensitive, just emotionally weak. And like I said, just a complete disaster. I couldn't handle life. You know, I would show up to a class 5 minutes late, and I'd look at my watch, and I'd be like, I can't walk in there. They're going to look at me. They're going to laugh. And so I'd be like, ah, screw it. I might as well just go drink anyway. And I'd walk away, and I would just go drink. And that's basically where I ended up, because I could not handle life without drinking. Even the smallest disruption to my emotional state, it's the only tool I had to control the way I felt was to drink. You know, so without that, was I happy? No, I was miserable. And even if the outside circumstances of my life improved, then it's like, oh yeah, I work better, I feel better. Like, yeah, I'm not waking up and like throwing up every single day. You know, I'm not finding like blood in my excrement anymore, but I still wished I could get drunk. Even on those brief times where I wasn't drinking, I still wished I could. Even though these outside circumstances look good and people would say things like, wow, you're doing so good. Look at you. You're actually showing up to class. You're going to work. You know, you're coming to family things and you're not breaking anything. And to other people, it looked like I was doing really well. But from the inside, it just felt like I was dying. It felt like I was withering away. And that's where I relate to this so strongly. Inwardly, I wish that I could take half a dozen drinks and get away with it. Because at that time, I didn't want to stop drinking. I just wanted to stop getting drunk involuntarily. You know? Like, I wanted to be able to drink and control it and enjoy it. Like they say, that's the obsession we have. So I ended up where the next couple sentences say, whereas he cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he'll be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he'll know loneliness such as few do. He'll be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. And at the end, that's where I was. I just wanted to die. And it was because it wasn't like a cry for help, like telling people I want to commit suicide. I mean, I learned my lesson. Like when I told somebody that I was thinking about committing suicide, I ended up in like a room with no doorknob. And I learned my lesson very quickly. You don't tell somebody that. You know, if you're going to plan to do it, you keep it quiet so that you can plan things out. And that's where I ended up. I was quietly planning things out, and I was looking for a way to kill myself that wouldn't hurt my parents and wouldn't hurt me too bad. It wouldn't be very painful. And I used to like just look at different things, and like I'd be on a balcony, I'm like, this is high enough. I don't know if I would hurt myself. Knowing my luck, I'd probably just fall and get injured, but I wouldn't actually die. And that's the kind of stuff that I used to think about. And, you know, I had like this old, like gigantic butcher knife, and I used to like run my finger along it and think like, you know, would I be able to actually like cut myself, stab myself? Would I die quickly enough? Would it make a mess? And that's where I was. I was wishing for the end. And why? Because, like I said, I had no tools. I had nothing. By that point, I couldn't trust myself. And I knew that I couldn't hold a promise to myself. I couldn't trust my own thinking because it was wrong on a regular basis. I couldn't trust my own feelings because they were like way out of proportion to everything all the time. And like, probably the worst thing is I looked at my life, a life that at one time, I was told anyway, had lots of potential, and it was all gone. It was all gone. You know, and at one time I had tried to follow the rules and do things the right way, and that was gone. And the person I had become was somebody who couldn't be trusted and who nobody wanted to be around. And it was just a husk waiting to die. And I looked at my life and there was just nothing there. It was bleak. And so I wanted that life to end. And I wanted me to end. I didn't know that it would be possible to get out of there and still be alive. But I mean, thank God there was another option through this program. Right? So, moving on from there, it says, we've shown how we got out from under. You say, yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? I always laugh when I see that because that's how I always thought of people who didn't drink. Stupid, boring, and glum. Right? And the people here who are like laughing, you get it too, right? Like, because the people I knew back in the day, the people I knew who didn't drink, weren't like the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They weren't like people who are hilarious and have, you know, funny stories and like crude sense of humor sometimes. You know, like the things that we do, they're not able to laugh at the things that we used to cry at. You know, and something bad would happen, and that would be it. Their whole life, you know, would be like a veil of tears. And here, when we have something bad happen, we get through it, we get to the other side, and then we help somebody else. It's totally different. I saw people who didn't drink as people who didn't know how to have fun. And now, I find that in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a whole group of people who actually know how to have fun, but who just don't drink when they do it. And, back in the day, I had no tools to deal with life. The people in these rooms have tools that actually work. And not like when I was a kid, when I was told, oh, don't lie, don't do this, don't do that. Here, people told me like, yeah, those are nice targets, but how do you get there? We have a series of specific actions you take that will get you to that spot. And I needed that. I needed instructions. I needed more than just the destination. I needed a map and a compass, you know, and it's like, this is the map and you guys are the compass. And I finally got there when I didn't know how to until I came here. So, yeah, I mean, people being stupid, boring, and glum, that's all I knew. And then I came here and I found you. And that's why it says, yes, there is a substitute. And it's vastly more than that. It's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. So, I mean, that sounds pretty darn familiar, right? It sounds an awful lot like when we first started talking about conviviality and colorful imagination and all that stuff. And to me, basically what this is saying is that the spiritual program of action we have is more than a sufficient substitute for alcohol because it does everything alcohol ever did and more. You know, like wanting to connect with people, wanting to have fun, wanting to, you know, deal with life successfully and have meaningful relationships. All of that stuff, it's like all the good without the side effects. You know? And the best thing is when you wake up the next day, you don't feel terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. You know? I don't think I've woken up once in recovery feeling those things. You know, I'm certainly felt tired or certainly felt back pain, but never terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. So, yeah, I think that it's absolutely spot on that they talk about the same things that we were looking for in alcohol we can get here. So, how is that to come about, you may ask? Where am I to find these people? I mean, where they were back then is quite different than now. You know, back then you had to actually really seek people out. And it wasn't easy. You know, people might be different states away. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have the internet. They had like old rotary phones and nothing. That's basically it. So to find people was legitimately difficult. It was like a journey. And today, you know, you just go on the internet, look up where the meeting is, and you're there. And all of a sudden, there's a room full of people. And it's a piece of cake to find other fellow travelers on this road of happy destiny. You know, it's so easy But it, I guess that's just a testament to the amount of effort that was put in by the people who paved the way for us, right? You know, because it's the fact that AA has survived for this long is a testament to the people who really worked this thing, who carried the message to other people, and the fact that our traditions have kept us alive by not getting embroiled in nonsense and conflict, you know, and enabled us to persevere through all of that crap, you know, all of the naysayers and all of the other, you know, treatment du jour that didn't work. But this does. And so it carries on, and we're here. So going on from there, it says, you're going to meet these new friends in your own community. Near you, alcoholics are dying helplessly like people in a sinking ship. If you live in a large place, there are hundreds, high and low, rich and poor. These are future fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. Among them, you will make lifelong friends. You will be bound to them with new and wonderful ties, for you will escape disaster together, and you will commence shoulder to shoulder your common journey. Then you will know what it means to give of yourself that others may survive and rediscover life. You will learn the full meaning of love thy neighbor as thyself. So, like so many things in this book, it was prescient, you know, like ahead of its time, almost like they could see the future, talking about, you know, people in their own community and alcoholics dying helplessly and we can go get them and stuff. Back then, it was like, you know, you go to your local hospital and you look for people to work with. And now it's like you go to your local church basement and there's like dozens of us all the time, you know. But my experience with this is that the friendships that I made in here are dramatically different than the friendships that I made while I was out drinking or even before drinking. And I still have, like, I'm going to say not a lot, but a handful of friends from back in my days when I was drinking, even like in high school. I went to a buddy's wedding in Wisconsin pretty recently, and we used to get drunk together all the time. So there are definitely people who are still in my life like that, but the style of friendship and the way that we communicate is different. You know, it's, I don't know if this makes sense, but I suspect you'll get it. It's more like we're friends head to head, whereas the friends in these rooms are heart to heart. You know, it's like we understand each other without even using words half the time. You know, like I heard a guy say he went to a meeting in a different country and he didn't understand a word, but he still laughed when they laughed because he knew what they were talking about. And I'm like, yeah, it's true, because there's just the shared experience we have both in our misery and suffering and in our way out bonds us in a way that just doesn't seem to exist elsewhere. But I think also one of the things that bonds us is our level of comfortability and non-judgment, and the fact that in here we're able to, we're given vocabulary and also a process to correctly identify our emotions, talk about them with other people, and get to the bottom of them in a way that's not shameful or fearful, which up until I was in here, I didn't have. So I'm able to connect with people in these rooms differently because we talk on a deeper level. You know, it's not just talking about events. It's talking about from inside. So, yeah. Now, talking about commencing shoulder to shoulder, when I sponsor people, I do this shoulder to shoulder with them. And that's the way that my sponsor did it with me as well. He was the first person, my first sponsor, the first person I ever met in my life who I felt like I was genuinely just as good as him, not any better or any worse. And it's the first time I ever felt that way in my life, really, because up until that point in my life, I was always comparing myself to other people and trying to figure out, am I better than them? Am I worse than them? Do I have to impress them? Do they have to impress me? You know, do I need to get something out of them? Are they trying to get something out of me? And then this was the first time in my life that I ever met somebody who really got it. Like, he understood me through and through. And I think the one thing I always think of and laugh is he talked about how when he was drinking and driving, he liked the bottle. He didn't like round bottles because they roll out from under the seat. And I'm like, oh, yeah, me too. And that just got me, because like he understood in a visceral manner the type of life that I had been living. But from there, he had something that was valuable to me, and he said I could have it for free, but he wasn't pushing it on me. He didn't want anything from me. He didn't care if I joined this fellowship or not, or if I took what he had to offer or not. He's just like, if you want this, you can have it, and if not, I wish you the best. You know, I genuinely want what's best for you, and if this isn't it, go do what you want. You know, and that was unique, because up until that point, everybody in my life was trying to tell me what to do, you know, because they saw the obvious misery inside of me, and they were telling me, why don't you just do this? Why can't you just blah, blah, blah? And he didn't do any of that. He's just like, I have a way out. If you want it, you can have it. If not, you know, let me know. And that's the way he did it with me, and that's the way I do that with my sponsees now. You know, I go to wherever they are. I give people rides. I remember, like, a number of years ago, there was a buddy called me, and he's like, oh, I have a young guy coming out of a rehab, and he's in bad shape, but he's a family friend, and I want you to, like, meet up with him and, you know, bring him to a meeting and whatnot. And so I drove, I picked him up, and we went together, and I just treated him like a regular guy, because that's what we are. We're just people. And gone were the days where I was always better or worse than somebody. Now I'm just one more, you know, and that's it. And I realized today that I don't have any more or less value than anybody. And so that's how I treat others. And that's how I, you know, I don't, earlier in working with others, it says don't talk down to the alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. I don't do that, because there's absolutely no need to. In fact, it's counterproductive to try and, like, lecture people and tell them what to do. And I don't know about you folks, but if somebody tells me what to do, I immediately resist that. It doesn't matter if it's the world's best advice. I don't want to be told what to do. It's just how I'm built. You know, and I'm better at taking directions now, but my first instinct is never, wow, that's a good idea. My first instinct is like, you're an idiot. Why are you telling me what to do? Right? So I think it's good advice, not only because it's a spiritual axiom that we love others as we love ourselves, and, you know, we're the same, but also because it just doesn't work. You know, trying to tell somebody what to do, it just doesn't work. And I think when trying to carry the message, that's the highest good, is what works. What works the best for me to help somebody else? What helps break through the shell so that I can do something useful to connect with this person? Because it doesn't matter how beautiful the language is or how good the intention is, if what you're doing doesn't work. So I take the advice here, you know. So, moving on from there, it says, it may seem incredible that these men are to become happy, respected, and useful once more. How can they rise out of such misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? The practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you. Should you wish them above all else and be willing to make use of our experience, we're sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. So, I think it's interesting. It's almost like a dodging of the question a little bit. And they say, like, how can they rise out of such misery? And it's like, well, it happened for us, so it can happen for you. And it's like, well, my experience is that the how is really going through this process. That's the how, in my experience. Like, how did I rise out of the misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? I did the process that I was taught in here. It's really that simple. And I'm going to say probably the things that helped me the most throughout the process were, I know a lot of people talk about 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th step. For me, it was probably 9, 10, 11, 12 that really made the difference, because it was almost like everything I did up until that point suddenly came alive and became operative in my life when I started, like, making amends to people and, you know, practicing 10, 11, and 12. It was like up until that point, it was almost, you know, me and my sponsor and God. And then all of a sudden, the whole rest of the world was brought into it, and it brought it alive as a way of life rather than just some academic adventure. You know? So yeah, the age of miracles is still with us. I don't know if this is controversial or not, but I know a lot of people talk about different things that happen in life or in the world that are miracles and whatnot. But for me, the miracles in my life aren't what happens around me or in the world. The miracle is that I see God's hand in it, and that I understand sometimes what my purpose is in it or what my lesson is, or that I can shut my mouth rather than open it. The miracle is that I can be gentle with my kids rather than being a tyrant. The miracle is that I can not judge somebody, or that I can walk into a room and not be better or worse than anybody. I know that there are definitely a lot of astonishing and amazing things that happen out there in the world. But for me, the miracle is that I'm no longer unhappy with being sober. That, to me, that's the greatest miracle. You know, all the stuff that I wanted before, like it says here, this substitute is, I hate calling it a substitute. This is like the real deal. The other thing was the substitute. Alcohol was the shitty substitute. This is the real thing. To me, that's the miracle. The miracle is that I have those things today and I don't have to drink for it. You know? So that's the age of miracles. It's still with us. So our hope is that when this chip of a book is launched on the world tide of alcoholism, defeated drinkers will seize upon it to follow its suggestions. Many, we are sure, will rise to their feet and march on. They will approach still other sick ones, and fellowships of Alcoholics Anonymous may spring up in each city and hamlet, havens for those who must find a way out. I think it's pretty self-evident that you know, again, was like as if they saw the future, because that is what happened, obviously. And groups popped up everywhere. And just in New Jersey alone, like, you could get a meeting at almost any hour of the day in almost every town. You know, within a 15-minute drive, I could get a meeting, like, every hour of the day if I wanted to. More, pretty close to it, anyway. And the interesting thing is that it's not like it's three people that are running every single meeting. It's like there's so many of us out there, and so many of them are involved in service. And what that means to me is that there's a lot of people out there who are really living the principles of this program, meaning like they're not just showing up and taking up a seat. There's a lot of people out there who are like chairing meetings, reading the big book, showing up early to read with a sponsee, or staying late, or whatever the deal is. People who like sweep the floor and whatever, because that's what we do. On the fellowship side, it is, I guess in hindsight, it's not surprising at all that we are where we are, because this thing freaking works. But at this time, it was just a hope. That's what they hoped. But I think if Bill saw where we were today, or Bob saw where we are today, I think they would be surprised that it spread as far as it did into so many different countries and translated into so many different languages, you know, and the tremendous amounts of literature that we have, and audio books and all these different things, and the conferences we have, and it really is like a worldwide phenomenon at this point. So yeah, absolutely. I think that their hope has been realized. And as long as we're good stewards of Alcoholics Anonymous, meaning like we continue to carry the message that's in this book and bring people through it, I think that we'll probably continue on the path that we are, which is not causing any conflict or drama in the world, just helping people, one alcoholic to another. So in the chapter Working with Others, you gathered an idea of how we approach and aid others to health. Suppose now that through you, several families have adopted this way of life. You'll want to know more of how to proceed from that point. Perhaps the best way of treating you to a glimpse of your future will be to describe the growth of the fellowship among us. Here's a brief account. Years ago, in 1935, one of our number made a journey to a certain western city. I always laugh because Bill always refers to himself in the third person like that, like a member of our fellowship and whatnot. Like, come on, we know exactly who you're talking about. But I love it because the experience that he had is so powerful that it needs to be reiterated. It's very useful as an illustrative anecdote, you know. So we'll go from there. From a business standpoint, his trip came off badly. Had he been successful in his enterprise, he would have been set on his feet financially, which at the time seemed vitally important. But his venture wound up in a lawsuit and bogged down completely. The proceeding was shot through with much hard feeling and controversy. Bitterly discouraged, he found himself in a strange place, discredited and almost broke. Still physically weak and sober but a few months, he saw that his predicament was dangerous. He wanted so much to talk with someone, but whom? One dismal afternoon, he paced a hotel lobby wondering how his bill was to be paid. At one end of the room stood a glass-covered directory of local churches. Down the lobby, a door opened into an attractive bar. He could see the gay crowd inside. In there, he would find companionship and release. Unless he took some drinks, he might not have the courage to scrape an acquaintance and would have a lonely weekend. So, I've been in places before where, like, I don't know, I was traveling for business, and you're in maybe a hotel lobby, and there's the hotel bar there. And anybody who's traveled like that before, where you're traveling solo, I'm not talking about like a family vacation, but traveling solo where you're like in a place where you literally have that choice of like, am I going to the bar or am I going to, you know, and well, I guess in our days it's to a meeting, it's not to the church directory. And I've done that in a variety of different places. You know, I remember like being in Pittsburgh and going to this club there and going to meetings because I'm staying there for a while. And I used to think it was just me, but now I think that it might be just like a common human thing. But if you're isolated from everybody you know, it's a pretty lonesome endeavor. You know, it's kind of hard. And I mean, I know there are people who love solitude. I'm not one of them. I can today comfortably handle solitude for periods of time, but I prefer to be around people. So in that situation, it is absolutely alluring to be around other people. But today, you know, I know that going to the bar to seek companionship is not the right move. And I guess one thing that, fortunately for me, is that I find drunk people to be really obnoxious these days, you know? And even like at a recent work event, everybody was drinking there. I'm like, God, these people, you know? So to some extent, I'm benefiting from a better situation than Bill had, because I am irritated by the drunk folks and I do have a meeting to go to. You know, which he didn't. But it does go on to say, of course he couldn't take a drink, but why not sit hopefully at a table, a bottle of ginger ale before him? After all, had he not been sober 6 months now? Perhaps he could handle, say, three drinks, no more. Fear gripped him. He was on thin ice. Again, it was the old insidious insanity, that first drink. With a shiver, he turned away and walked down the lobby to the church directory. Music and gay chatter still floated to him from the bar. But what about his responsibilities, his family and the men who would die because they would not know how to get well? Ah, yes, those other alcoholics. There must be many such in this town. He would phone a clergyman. His sanity returned and he thanked God. Selecting a church at random from the directory, he stepped into a booth and lifted the receiver. So, I can say that the people that I feel responsible for, you know, like the brand new people, the people who come in and it's their first meeting ever, and they're like looking to get out the door as soon as the meeting's over. That's the reason that to this day my home group is still a newcomers meeting, because I try to go there and put my hand out for those folks, and I do feel responsible for that, and for my family, and for all of these other things today. Because the interesting thing is when you become responsible, all of a sudden you find you have responsibility. It just comes right in, right? And when you become reliable, all of a sudden people start relying on you. And my experience with this is that helps anchor me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's not like I'm coming here just for me anymore. I'm coming here because I have a responsibility, because I care about more than just me today. You know, and like in the beginning, I was just trying to figure out what I could take away from every meeting. You know, thinking like, oh, I'll wait till I hear something good and I'll take that with me. And now today I'm like, maybe I could go there and I could be the one person who shakes the new guy's hand. Or I could be the one person who actually listens to that person that no one else wants to listen to. And by the way, I'm not a saint. A lot of times those people that nobody listens to, it's for a good reason. And I'll listen to them and be like, oh my God, they're talking forever. But I try. I really do. Because I know what it's like to be the person nobody wants to listen to. You know, and I love the people that are unlovable, because I used to be like that. And I know what that's like, and I relate to that. And my wife always busts my chops about it, you know, but it's who I am. You know, the people who maybe like need to take a shower, those are my people. I love to go and talk with those folks, because I know that they need the love. You know, the hardest people to love are the ones who need it the most. So yeah, I do absolutely feel responsible, and I feel like if it wasn't for those people, I wouldn't be here. And I don't mean sitting in this room, although that's obviously true. I mean, like, I wouldn't still be on this earth. You know, it gives me a sense of purpose. And when they talk about life taking on new meaning, prior to that, my life didn't have meaning. I remember even when I was drinking and I was, like, having fun drinking, I didn't have a purpose. And so, therefore, I never really accomplished anything in my life, and I never really felt like there was anything of value or of worth. And I share this a lot, but it's so important to me that I remember I was maybe in the eighth grade and I looked at my parents and said, like, what is the point of all of this stuff? And they're like, what? I mean, like, life. What's the point? And they went through this whole series of things that they thought would be, you know, good and reasons to, like, you know, get excited about life. Oh, you work hard and then you get a good job, and maybe you have kids and you get a car and a house. And I remember saying, I don't know if I said it in these words, but like, for what? Why? Why would I want any of that? And I didn't have the vocabulary to describe it at the time, but what I was thinking is, none of that is going to make me happy. Because I knew, and even at that time, I knew that arranging the outside was not going to make me feel whole on the inside. I had no sense of purpose. I had no connection to anything. I had no reason to be in this world. And I was contributing nothing to this world, so therefore I had no value. And I knew it. So yeah, coming here, I mean, today I thank God, just like Bill did, that my sanity is returned and that I have an opportunity to be useful and have a purpose to try and, you know, reach out to the new person. It's saved my life in more ways than one. So, is called to the clergyman, led him presently to a certain resident of the town who, though formerly able and respected, was then nearing the nadir of alcoholic despair. It was the usual situation. Home in jeopardy, wife ill, children distracted, bills in arrears, and standing damaged. He had a desperate desire to stop, but saw no way out, for he had earnestly tried many avenues of escape. Painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, the man did not fully realize what it meant to be alcoholic. And I love the little asterisk. This refers to Bill's first visit with Dr. Bob. Like, as if we didn't know by this point. But, yeah, the usual situation, right? Because if we drink alcoholically for an extended period of time, that's pretty much where we end up. We end up where life is an absolute disaster. So, our friend related his experience. The man agreed that no amount of willpower he might muster could stop his drinking for long. A spiritual experience, he conceded, was absolutely necessary, but the price seemed high upon the basis suggested. He told how he lived in constant worry about those who might find out about his alcoholism. He had, of course, the familiar alcoholic obsession that few knew of his drinking. Why, he argued, should he lose the remainder of his business, only to bring still more suffering to his family by foolishly admitting his plight to people from whom he made his livelihood? He would do anything, he said, but that. You know what they say, half measures avail us nothing, right? So, being intrigued, however, he invited our friend to his home. Sometime later, and just as he thought he was getting control of his liquor situation, he went on a roaring bender. For him, this was the spree that ended all sprees. He saw he would have to face his problems squarely, that God might give him mastery. One morning, he took the bull by the horns and set out to tell those he feared what his trouble had been. He found himself surprisingly well received and learned that many knew of his drinking. Stepping into his car, he made the rounds of people he had hurt. He trembled as he went about, for this might mean ruin, particularly to a person in his line of business. At midnight, he came home exhausted but very happy. He has not had a drink since. As we shall see, he now means a great deal to his community, and the major liabilities of 30 years of hard drinking have been repaired in 4. So I think that speaks to the incredible potential that the steps have in them. I presume everybody knows the story behind this, where Bob had went and got drunk, and then the next morning he was shaky, so they had to give him a couple beers so he could go provide a surgery, And then they were worried that, he hadn't come home, and they're like, oh, shit, he went out drinking again. But then it turns out that he was actually out making amends, and he came home super late, and then he didn't drink after that. Because, they say that we get our sanity back in step 10, so after you've completed making your amends, it sort of makes sense, right? And so my experience, like I said, was that the revolution for me came somewhere in between 9 and 12. And all of the steps up to that point paved the way and made the ground fertile and planted the seeds and watered it and all of that stuff. But then where it really sprouted was when I made amends to other people and got honest with them. And it was like, the person that I had pretended to be my whole life finally shattered and no longer was between me and other people. And it was like, I had been living pretending that I was, all of these different things. Like, I had sort of crafted a persona for myself, and I always, I had catchphrases. Like, I was such a... Exactly. And I was absolutely hollow on the inside, because I was what I thought everybody else wanted me to be. And once I got real with people, it's like all of a sudden they knew who I was, and the connection that I always sought was suddenly there. I leveled with them. And what I also found is that through the process of amends, a lot of stuff that I was mad about, I found out that I wasn't really mad because of what they did. I was mad because it was my justification that made my behavior look less awful. You know, if they did this to me, then I was justified in doing this. But when I clear my side of the street, all of a sudden I found that their side of the street really wasn't that bad in the first place. It was just held on to as justifications for my own bad behavior. And to this day, I find that when I make amends to somebody else, the crap that I feel against them almost always goes away. Almost always. And so through doing a 10th step and really trying to admit when I'm wrong and clear the wreckage of my present, so to speak, I find that even now, if I am angry at somebody, that spiritual axiom is true. There's something wrong with me. And when I clear my side of the street, the other side just somehow cleans itself. It's getting pretty close to that time, so I'll close with this. Last night I stopped over at the cigar shop in Cranford because some folks that I know from the program were playing poker. And we get together sometimes and we just play cards. It's not like a high-stakes game or anything. It's just for fun. And I went there and I just hung out and had a cigar. And I didn't play. I was just spending time with my people. And while I was there, I had everything that this chapter promises me. I had a fellowship with people that I am close with who know me and who I know and we're valuable to each other and we make ridiculous jokes and our imaginations are fired and, you know, we have a great freaking time. And it's exactly the kind of times that I used to want to have drinking. And today I get to have them sober. The only difference is, like I said, I don't wake up anymore wondering what happened the night before or fearing what might have happened the night before. And I don't wake up like and then vomit. Most of the time. I mean, sometimes, but that's only when I'm actually sick, right? But today my life is authentically good. Unlike before, where it had the appearance of a good life on the outside, today it's authentically good from the inside out. And it's because of this process. And I really like A Vision for You because I feel like this is, on a good day, what it's like living the principles of this program with a group of other people who are on the same path. You know, when things are going well, they are absolutely gorgeous. And when they're not, we have tools to get through them until we get to the other side. And the great thing is we get to learn. Instead of avoiding and dodging problems, we get to learn from them and we grow. And every pain can be a growing pain if you're willing to grow through it. So with that, thank you very much for letting me talk to you for this time, and I'll close there.